Welcome to the podcast version of Sunday Miscellany, which differs from the radio version for rights reasons. We hope you enjoy the programme.
I'm standing on the deck of the Sea Shepherd vessel Allan Kay, staring out to sea. We're sailing south of Deception Island, making our way down the western coast of the Antarctic Peninsula, and this evening we're being treated to a beautiful sunset after a day of freezing fog. This mountainous, snow-covered finger of the last continent, as it's called, stretches north into the Drake Passage, reaching out for Cape Horn and the southernmost tip of the Americas. Tracking a few miles offshore, we pick our way through a vast field of icebergs. Portside, the mountains are towering into and above the clouds. Starboard and out to sea, the waning light is illuminating 1,000 frozen sculptures in shades of gold and pink. The tranquility of our surroundings is a welcome change. We've been more than a month at sea, starting with a storm-ridden passage across the South Atlantic. Swells tower to 12 metres, causing the ship to pitch and roll violently. Spray swept across the decks, confining the 20 of us on board indoors for nearly a week before Neptune finally lost interest in us. I'm a volunteer crew member on this ship, and our mission is one of environmental activism, to bear witness to and document the fleet of super trawlers combing the seas around Coronation Island for krill, the foundational species of the Antarctic ecosystem. We shadowed the fleet as vessels over 100 metres long barged through pods of feeding whales, taking the food from their mouths. Krill trawlers keep their nets in the water continuously, using giant vacuums to suck out the entangled sea life. On board those floating factories, krill is ground and boiled. Some will eventually be fed to farmed salmon on Ireland's Atlantic coast. We followed the fleet for a week, and then the weather forecast told us to run for cover. We didn't quite make it to the peninsula before the storm caught us. Wind rushed over the decks, howling and whining. Icebergs the size of houses loomed alongside us. Our searchlights combed the waves all night for danger. Only now, in the aftermath, do we admit to each other, over bowls of hot soup, how little we slept, the fear we felt. Come 9 p.m. on the ship's clock, and the crew is dispersing for the evening. Common spaces quieten, and cabin doors close. I've ducked back into my cabin, and I'm starting to peel back my many layers of insulative clothing when the intercom sounds. The voice of French First Officer Baptiste crackles through from the bridge. All crew, orcas on the bow. Before he can finish, you can hear doors slamming and thundering footsteps. The whole crew is scrambling towards the bow in shorts in place of thermal leggings and waterproof trousers, flip-flops or shoes with laces undone. The price for this hastiness is paid at once. A cold wind leaves exposed flesh, first numb, then stinging in pain. But the price of delay could be far greater, an opportunity missed, never to return. We chat nervously, scanning the smooth surface of the ocean until we see the orca blow again, at a bearing of 9 o'clock to us and a range of half a mile. Another blow, and then a towering black dorsal fin, unmistakable. We whoop and cheer as we see a whole family of orca, the ocean's apex predator, breathe in unison. The pod is transiting north, and after a few more sightings, their fins fade into the distance behind us. But the show goes on. Everything is more extreme at sea. Bad days are barely survivable. Gravity becomes a violent, unpredictable force, and you're flung around like a rag doll as the ocean heaves. Corridors warp and twist, hatches snap shut like bear traps. Bad days can become bad weeks, and bad weeks can become bad voyages. Equally, when good things happen, they tend to keep happening. When it comes to the mysterious world of the ocean's depths and the secrets of the frozen far south, there seems no end to the treasures that can be bestowed upon you. Now, off the bow, port side, there's a splash. It's further off this time, maybe a mile range at a bearing of 11 o'clock. Stillness. a humpback whale comes up for air, then dives, showing the intricate beauty of its fluke to the fiery evening sky. The assembly once again becomes unsettled, anxious in anticipation. Then, an eruption. From the depths, the humpback rises with speed, breaking the surface, abandoning the underwater world, and joining life above. For an eternal moment, it hangs in the light, then crashes with a tremendous splash back to the world below. Laughter, joy, hugs. Then someone calls out that the whale has come up for air. Bated breath. Now comes the dive and the whale tail. We count, 20 seconds elapse, and the jester leaps clear into the sky again. Euphoria on the deck of the Alan Kay. Camera shutters click and we celebrate and mourn in equal measure, for such a perfect moment cannot truly be captured, only lived. The humpback breaches a further four times as the Alan Kay sails on to the southwest and into the gathering twilight. I linger on deck, reveling in the atmosphere and wondering what else lies ahead on our voyage.
I'm dubious about this vogue for distressed furniture. It seems an odd practice to apply anemic, chalky paint to a perfectly good table or dresser, then use what the DIY people call distressing mediums, sandpaper and paint stripper, to deliberately make the piece look weathered and dented. Rustic accents, knots and superficial damage are the hallmarks of shabby chic, apparently. The distressed look sometimes requires a more direct method, as the belt of a hammer is needed to batter in divots, or an awl is used to scrape the surface with a long scratch. There was no need to deliberately weather or damage the few sticks of furniture we had in my growing up years. No techniques required to add textural appeal or tonal variation. Our furniture was procured in a variety of odd ways. Maggie Rowe, whose husband Johnny worked in the meat factory, could always be relied upon to pass on unwanted pieces to us. When Johnny got a bonus, Maggie would replace the kitchen cabinet or a few chairs with new ones. The old furniture always came our way. The matter of transporting the Bounty was solved by borrowing the Clonmore Jennet. The Jennet, named Clonmore because he came from that townland, was a neat, muscular little animal whose braying delighted us. We were like frontier characters from a western when we yoked up the cart to Clonmore and led her to Rose House, where the new, second-hand furniture awaited us. Maggie's place was better than any high-end showroom, as she pointed out the kitchen cabinet or formica table destined for us. "Not a brack on it," my mother would always declare, as she slid open the doors of the cabinet or ran her fingers along the shiny veneer of formica. There would be the usual insistence that money should change hands, but Johnny would always counter this by saying he'd gotten the bonus. "There'll be plenty furniture after us," he'd add, something I still imagine I hear him say when I visit the Rose grave near to my parents' plot. No money changed hands between neighbours, but other opportunities to compensate would present themselves. We'd have an abundance of rhubarb and cabbage to share and onions to beat the band. As the furniture was roped onto the Jennet's cart, we promised we'd be back. Maggie's furniture fitted in perfectly in our house. Mishmash and mismatch was the aesthetic of our era. Our 1960s decor made plain statements about survival, but it also spoke eloquently of our efforts at variety and charm. My mother was a great one for the jumble sales in the parochial hall, where she bought the wonderful array of artwork that decorated our walls. The vintage pictures usually depicted domestic scenes reminiscent of her own childhood. A grandmother mused by an open fire, a younger woman peeled potatoes, while a child in a white pinny drew a pull-along toy over the flag floor to the amusement of a kitten. One original work took pride of place, a parrot painted by my brother Patsy. The bird splayed a gorgeous and imaginative array of cobalt and orange feathers. It was a great source of pleasure to us that the barber, Mr. Gregg, who once visited our house, was very taken by the picture. He wanted to buy it for his shop in Castle Street Care, but my parents refused. They agreed, however, that he could borrow it for a specified time. Our Patsy's parrot might as well have hung in the National Gallery, so great was our pride. Every Christmas, these paintings were removed from the walls with great care so that the elaborate frames could be gold-dusted. No restoration artist worked as diligently as my mother when she tapped out the file of gold dust into a little tin container and added in the drops of resinous oil until the solution darted like mercury. The gold dust was applied with a little brush until the frames shone with a green-gold, brassy hue. Another item of furniture that exuded glamour and romance in our house was the table nailed together as a wedding present for my mother by a travelling man with a Hollywood name, Rupert Keating. Rupert was one of the many knights of the road who was made welcome in my mother's home place. I recall the little table as a sturdy object in the scullery. I recall too that my father often found fault with it. Every winter, I feared that his threat to chop it up for firewood might come treacherously to pass. I expect he felt jealous of whatever affection prompted the travelling man to knock together the table and proffer it as a gift. I wouldn't swap the second-hand furniture gifted by Maggie Rowe and carried to our house by the Clonmore Jinnet for all the Art Deco glitz in any showroom. How could the bespoke and fine-lined hold a candle to the furniture that passed from neighbour to neighbour in the unspoken understanding that we relied upon one another? What table would ever compete with a true original, a Rupert Keating creation?
If I were a carpenter and you were a lady, would you marry me anyway? Would you have my baby?
What object would you never part with? It's a standard question in a Sunday supplement interview series that I find intriguing. My answer? A battered old wooden chest in our spare bedroom, with S. Campbell, RN, stenciled in faint letters on the lid. It was in this box that my great-granduncle carried his belongings on voyages to far-flung places in the 1860s and 1870s. It's still sturdy 150 years later, even if bits are missing from some of the corners. Chewed away by rats, my granny used to say. Samuel Campbell was a surgeon in the Royal Navy. He grew up on a farm on the Fannet Peninsula in North Donegal, and maybe the sea was in his psyche, for the fields he would have played in as a child ran down to the shores of Mulroy Bay. When I was a child, playing around that same farm with my sister on summer visits, so many stories were told about Uncle Doctor, as he was known, that we sensed his presence like a benign ghost. I have the photograph album that went with him on his travels, a small book with gilt-edged pages that must have been extra precious at a time when photography was thrillingly new. I'm looking at a picture of him now, in full dress uniform, brass buttoned and braided, a well-built man with a Victorian beard and crinkly, smiling eyes. In a more informal portrait, with his cane at a jaunty angle, he looks dapper, a dandy almost, in amongst images of Disraeli, the Prince of Wales, three-masted sloops, Japanese pagodas, and his own Donegal front door. Uncle Doctor spent most of his working life on surveying expeditions. As a keen botanist, he was encouraged to take an active part in survey work besides looking after sick seamen. His service record shows these additional duties earned him an extra 2 shillings and 6 pence a day from 1859 on, a nice little bonus at the time, with nothing to spend it on for months on end. One expedition took him through the Straits of Magellan to the southernmost tip of Patagonia. 4 watercolours on our living room wall, painted by the ship's artist, show him on horseback chasing llamas across the plains of Tierra del Fuego and parleying with a tribal chief. The chief has a fine-looking dog, which Uncle Sam apparently admired, only, the story went, to be served the unfortunate hound later for dinner. He helped to chart the coasts of China, Japan and Korea, either fighting off or mollifying the locals depending on how things went. In one of just 2 letters that survive, written in 1876, he describes a cruise up the North Korean coast. "We steamed into a region entirely unknown, where no European had ever been. The next day," he writes, "a village headman explained through an interpreter that his people thought the sailors had come to eat them and carry away their women." When Uncle Doctor was on leave, he returned to the family farm near Kerrykeel, laden with gifts: Chinese porcelain, Japanese lacquerware, a samurai sword, a carved emu's egg, even, rather rakishly, an opium pipe. He bought gold watches for his sisters and paid the school fees of his favourite niece, Mary. Later, he would take Mary to London and kit her out with fancy gowns before whisking her off to the French Riviera, where he spent the winters of his retirement. Maybe he wanted to mix with the beau monde, or maybe he had a weak chest and went there for the weather. I suspect the latter. He died of pneumonia back in Donegal, having spent too much time, they said, out on duck shoots, lying in wet heather. That was all we knew about Uncle Doctor until a letter from British Columbia landed into my grandmother's lap in 1977. It was from a librarian in Campbell River on Vancouver Island. As she must know, it said, the town had been named after Dr. Samuel Campbell. Could our family provide any information that might help a local historian to flesh out a biography? Could we what? Uncle Doctor must have done something heroic to have a town named after him. My grandmother threw herself into the task, with me as willing secretary. We drew the family tree, typed up his letters, copied photographs, recorded reminiscences. Only when the booklet was published did we learn that places marked on naval surveys were routinely given the names of any crew members at all. No heroism required. But to me, Uncle Doctor was a hero, a real traveller, instead of the tame, cosseted kind I have become. What challenges he must have faced. What, I would love to know, did he make of those very foreign countries? His sea chest holds my granny's old linen tablecloths now, and my wild imaginings.
On moving day, my husband and I meet the estate agent at our new address, to be greeted by a helium balloon from the previous owners tied to the banister. "Congratulations," it declares enthusiastically. the blue and pink design indicating it had been intended for another purpose. The estate agent hovers in the living room whilst we walk around the property, checking for what we aren't quite sure. Has the damp in the corner of the bedroom always been there? Why is there condensation in the windows of the conservatory? I look at my husband, a familiar look of panic in both of our faces. I leave you to it so, when you're ready, the estate agent calls from the front of the house, and off she goes, leaving us to our own devices. It's not so dissimilar to having a baby, moving house. You become so focused on the big day, it's easy to forget that all the real action takes place in the aftermath. It's not a one-day event. It's an immersion into a world of new noises and sensations, of misunderstanding and not knowing. It's your life, but not as you know it. We didn't get a manual when we became parents 13 years ago, and nor did we receive one to prepare us for the move. So here we are again, decades later, baffled by adulthood. There's so much we don't understand. The shower. What's a thermostatic valve? The hob. Why does it take so long to make scrambled eggs? Why does one radiator in the bedroom heat to a level unbearable to the touch whilst the other remains tepid? There are a few instruction leaflets left for kitchen appliances, but mostly we're left to figure it out ourselves. We have to be grown-ups. The biggest mystery is the switch in the living room. It sits just above the skirting board to the right of the fireplace. It looks like a light switch, but when you flick it, no lights come on. Instead, a gasping, gurgling noise rises through the walls, like a belch. This house, like the metaphorical baby, can't keep quiet. It's constantly whining, groaning, burping. We organise a roofer to come and look at the roof, hoping it'll fix the apparent leak in our son's bedroom. The roofers arrive and do the job. Then they tell us there's more work to be done. So they come back again the next day and do that. We allow ourselves a moment's smug satisfaction at getting things done. After a few days, I notice a stain on the floor in the living room. Two grey spots at the corner by the door from the hall. I glance up and sure enough, there is the shadowy telltale sign of water trickling in from the ceiling above. By now, we have unboxed the majority of our belongings, or at least the ones we use on a regular basis. I have created a cosy reading nook for myself in the living room. My old reading chair, our old IKEA bookcases filled with my favourite books. And yet everything looks unfamiliar in its new home. It's very disconcerting, an uncanny version of our lives. The furniture we have brought is contemporary, functional. The decor on this house is, let's say, traditional. They are mismatched. It's like looking in the mirror and expecting to see the 20-year-old version of yourself, only to be confronted with a 43-year-old who looks kind of like you, except really tired. But the living room is my favourite room in the house so far. It's south-facing, a fact I only learned by downloading the Compass app onto my phone. And when the sun comes in through the large window, even in February, the whole room is warmed. The wallpaper is yellow, the reading chair and matching footstool are yellow, the daffodils. It's like sitting in the oozing yolk of a perfectly poached egg. Delicious. I put my feet up and bask in the sun like a contented cat. The leaks are all fixed. The shower is hot, the hob and the heating mastered. The mysterious switch is the only puzzle remaining to be solved. After 2 weeks, we admit defeat and email the estate agent. Would it be possible to ask the previous owners what the switch in the living room does?
We are a family now. We're a family now.
After a lapse of almost 40 years, I can still recall the excitement my wife Greta and I felt as we set off for a new life in Australia in 1985 with a baby and a toddler in tow. We were bound for Greta's home city of Perth, where I was to teach at a university there. During the 2 years I spent in what locals call WA, I came to love the wide open spaces of that vast territory, similar in scale to the whole of Western Europe, but with a tiny population of just over 1 million at that time. I took a particular interest in Western Australia's rich Irish connections, epitomised by Clareman Paddy Hannon, who discovered gold there in 1890, triggering the last great Australian gold rush and setting off a mining boom that continues to this day. Then there was the Irish engineer C.Y. O'Connor, who was responsible for building the port of Fremantle and the waterworks that supplied the burgeoning mining communities of Coolgardie and Kalgoorlie at the turn of the 19th century. Today, O'Connor is memorialised with an equestrian statue on a Perth beach that now bears his name. After 2 happy years in Perth, Greta and I returned to Ireland so that I could resume my position in our diplomatic service. In the years that followed, we continued to return to Perth as often as finances would permit. We paid a visit last year to mark my retirement and Greta's significant birthday. Travelling up the coast from the wine-producing area of Margaret River, on a quiet stretch of road on the shores of the Indian Ocean, in a grove of trees, I came across a memorial that highlights another Irish connection with that faraway land. It remembers the Fenian John Boyle O'Reilly, who was born in County Meath on the eve of the Great Famine. He was involved in newspaper work in Ireland and Britain before joining the British Army. O'Reilly was convicted of recruiting servicemen into the Fenians and was transported to Western Australia in 1867. The cell he occupied in Fremantle Prison can still be visited, but the indomitable O'Reilly did not remain there for long. Aided by a local Irish priest, Father Patrick McCabe, O'Reilly escaped on board an American whaling ship and made his way to the United States, arriving in Philadelphia in November 1869. He subsequently settled in the Boston area, where he continued his involvement with Irish nationalism, working with fellow Fenians to organise the celebrated rescue of 6 Fenian prisoners from Western Australia on board the Catalpa. O'Reilly's writing and editorial skills stood to him in his new home. He became editor and owner of the Boston Pilot, at that time the leading Catholic newspaper in America. He did a considerable service to Irish literature by publishing regular essays by W.B. Yeats, in which he elaborated some of the ideas that powered the Irish literary revival of the 1890s. The fee of £1 for each article when it arrived through Yeats's letterbox was always a welcome source of financial relief to the impecunious poet. O'Reilly became a prominent figure during America's Gilded Age, befriending the leading American writers of that time, Longfellow and Emerson. His sympathies ranged well beyond the concerns of Irish Americans, and he argued for improved conditions for workers and for fairer treatment of African Americans during the repressive Jim Crow era that followed the American Civil War. One of his best-known poems celebrates Crispus Attucks, a man of African and Native American extraction who was killed during the Boston Massacre of 1770, which brought about the American War of Independence. For the egalitarian O'Reilly, there was never a separate heartbeat in all the races of men. John Boyle O'Reilly also praised the exploits of the Irish Brigade at the Battle of Fredericksburg, who charged for their flag to the grim cannon's mouth. I have visited that Civil War battlefield and seen for myself how brave the Irish needed to be to run up that hill under intense fire. With an inclusiveness typical of him, O'Reilly recognised too the valour of those Irish who fought on the Confederate side. His conclusion was that, "Who loveth the flag is a man and a brother, no matter what birth or what race or what creed." John Boyle O'Reilly was just 46 years old when he died in 1890 of an accidental overdose of sleeping medicine. His death was widely mourned, and his funeral was attended by the US President Benjamin Harrison. During my visit to Western Australia last year, I had a further brush with the O'Reilly legend as I watched Ireland play Scotland in the Rugby Six Nations at the John Boyle O'Reilly pub in a Perth suburb, complete with a replica of the rowing boat in which he made his initial escape. I found myself surrounded by a new generation of Irish exiles, totally different from those O'Reilly wrote of in his poem The Exile of the Gael, whose songs, he said, were saddened by thoughts of desolate days. In an exuberant throng of young Irish toasting another Irish rugby triumph, there was no hint of Desolation Row on that balmy night in Perth.
I'm tired of planning and toiling in the crowded hives of men. Heart weary of building and spoiling and spoiling.
A couple of years ago, there was an exhibition in Dublin Castle called The Objects of Love. It gathered together memorabilia left behind by the family of Oliver Sears, which was brutally dispersed in Nazi-occupied Poland. I wrote this piece in response to the exhibition. It's called Visible Mending. Consider textiles. The warmth of a woolen jumper. The comfort of cashmere. The airtight insulation of fur. Consider how uniquely human it is to fabricate clothing and wear it. Consider then the process of removing everything that distinguishes a person as human, that deprives them of their humanity, reduces them to a number. Consider the Nuremberg laws. Consider being banned from visiting parks, restaurants, and swimming pools, from owning radios, records, or telephones, from riding bicycles, and from keeping pets. Consider being ineligible for clothing ration cards, being forced to hand over all garments made of wool and fur. Consider how cold it gets in Central Europe, and being forbidden to wear anything but woven textiles. Consider the flax fields of Poland, the vast expanses of blue-flowered plants dancing into the distance. Scythed green sheaves. The stench of retting fibres catches in my throat. The rattle of seed pods. Golden streams of linseed spill into trailers. Coarse strands of flax coiled around the distaff. The clanking of looms. Consider the city of Łódź, the country's largest centre for spinning, dyeing and weaving linen. Consider Moses Rosenfeld, who founded a flourishing textile factory there. Consider Hitler's armies crossing into Poland from Silesia, and how the Rosenfelds, like so many other Jewish families, were brutally dispersed. Last family portrait. Together in the shade of towering tree trunks. Glints of sunshine on empty factory windows. The drape of cedars. Sniper's sightline. From the child's hiding place, sweet papers rustle. Receding train tracks. On outstretched palms, a gold powder compact. Red-stamped papers, smudged with whirling fingerprints. See how they spiral. Consider a world being repaired. Consider the Navajo spider woman weaving the universe into existence. Consider the three Moirai. Tlautho spinning the thread of life for each person born. Lachesis measuring the length of their thread. And Atropos, determining when it should be cut off. Consider visible mending, where each repair is a statement, a valuable addition, where each strengthens the original fabric. Consider each of these hard-saved mementos as a patch lovingly applied, a skillful darn, in the flawed fabric of history.
On this morning's programme, we heard First Glimpse of the Antarctic Peninsula by Hugh Weldon. A Few Sticks of Furniture was by Margaret Galvin. Uncle Doctor by Mary Dewey. The Move was by Beth Kilkenny. Reliving the Life of O'Reilly by Daniel Mulhall. And Visible Mending, a response to The Objects of Love by Amanda Bell. The music was Ghost on the Waves by Claire Sands and Aisling Irwin. If I Were a Carpenter by Bobby Darin. South Australia by the Clancy Brothers and Tommy Makem. Dandelion Seed by Greenshine. And The Cry of the Dreamer, a poem by John Boyle O'Reilly, set to music and sung by Sean Tyrrell. And Visible Mending, a response to The Objects of Love by Amanda Bell, was originally commissioned by Holocaust Awareness Ireland. Sunday Miscellany's broadcast coordinator is Elaine Conlon. The producer is Sarah Binchy. And you can listen back on the RTE Radio app or on all the usual podcast platforms. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.
You've been listening to the Sunday Miscellany podcast. For more from us, you can follow the programme on Facebook, Twitter, Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Just search for RTE Sunday Miscellany.